Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you very much. Chuck Morse, Blog Talk Radio, veteran talk show host. I'm awaiting my guest, who is Mark Wertman. He's an independent historian and award-winning freelance journalist. He's the author of two books, previous books, from the what I'm talking about today, The Millionaire's Unit, The Aristocratic Flyboys Who Fought the Great War and Invented American Air Power, and The Bonfire, The Siege and Burning of Atlanta. His book is 1941, Fighting the Shadow War, A Divided America in a World at War. Mark will hopefully be calling in shortly. Doing a Blog Talk Radio has its difficulties, but it keeps my hand in radio as I, continue to develop my sort of a platform, if you will, in media. And just since I'm on that topic briefly, before we get to the content of the book, I recently discovered this amazing technology on Facebook, which allows me to broadcast live and streamed right from a Facebook page, a business page you set up as part of your Facebook account. And you can see me, you can hear me, and I'm doing it as I drive Uber. I drive Uber in Boston. It's one of my many jobs. I also write life and health insurance policies. And it's great fun. I call it the Boston Uberman. And I basically do brief segments in between my Uber clients. So you can check that out on Facebook. I'm having a great time doing that. Anyway, Mark Wertman is with us. And Mark is the author, as mentioned previously, of 1941, Fighting in the Shadow War, A Divided America in a World at War. Mark, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you, Chuck. Good to be here.
Mark, your book deals with a very interesting year, and that was after World War II had been launched by the Nazis and by the Soviets when they marched in and divided up Poland in September of 1939. Europe into war, bringing up Britain and France in because they had signed a treaty with England, with Poland, agreeing to go to war if Poland had been attacked. But the United States was not in it yet. And, in fact, we would not get in it until the end of 1941, the date which will live in infamy, that being December 7th, when the Imperial Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. So there was a lot going on in the country in those years. And I think you do a very good job of illustrating it, and I appreciate your book.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, that I had always been concerned about why the U.S. allowed Hitler to progress for so long, why the U.S. didn't come in with military force in response to the conquests in Europe. And why, as a I'm of Jewish background, and was always aware that both some members of my family were killed in the Holocaust, and others who were refugees were not permitted to come into the country. You know, why the U.S. did not, when news was already filtering back about atrocities, why the U.S. didn't. Raise at least the moral flag. And so that led me down that path into that two-plus-year period when the U.S. Became the arsenal of democracy, but it was explicitly not the army of democracy.
You know, it's kind of a separate topic, but I'm also Jewish, and I've been interested in the phenomena of the Evian Conference, which was held in 1940, I believe. And that basically led by the United States delegation in France, it was just before the invasion of France, where we basically put a ban on any Jewish emigration, not only into the United States, but into other Western nations. I mean, it was shortly after that the United States told the Cuban government to turn back a shipload of Jewish refugees because they weren't allowed to land. They ended up having to go back to Nazi Germany. So, there was a strange agreement.
Louis.
That's right. It was a strange agreement on the part of the Western democracies to ban any Jewish immigration, including to Palestine. One of the few countries that actually did some was Great Britain with the Kinder transport. But other than that, it was just a shutdown of a ban of it, and there was no discussion of it. Franklin Roosevelt never discussed it publicly until the end of the war. And it's just a separate topic. But the issue at hand in your book is 1941, why is it that we didn't get in the war sooner? There was a major peace movement in the United States, which I learned a lot about from reading your book. And it was anti-war. It did not want to get in. It was made up. I mean, the big figures in it were Charles Lindbergh, who, based on some of the chilling things that he said that you recount in your book, clearly was an anti-Semite, but and involved with this very bizarre Jewish conspiracy theories. But but I think it's also, is it not true that this peace movement was much broader than that? It included people on the left, right, and center. And generally, Americans did not want to intervene in this foreign war.
At this time in 1941, right around now, there was a Gallup poll taken that found that that 75% of the respondents said that if Great Britain fell, and at this point Great Britain was fighting on effectively alone against the Nazis and had gone through the Blitz, its convoys were under attack, which were the essential lifeline to supplying an island nation, that if Great Britain fell, Americans by 75% felt that this would represent a serious danger to the United States. And that same poll found that more than 80% said that even at the risk of Great Britain falling, that Americans should not enter the war. So there was a very broad sentiment in the country. And as you said, it was left, right, and center. On the left, right up until June 22, 1941, when the Germans invaded the Soviet Union, the Communist Party was strongly against American intervention in what it considered to be an imperialist war. And, of course, as soon as Hitler invaded the Soviet Union, the Communist Party did a 180-degree turn and said, this is our war. We need to come right away to the aid of the Allies. On the far right, there were people like Charles Lindbergh, who, as you mentioned, was strongly anti-Semitic, although many of his biographers and people who study him don't actually perceive him that way. But I spent time looking at his private diaries from the period that are kept at Yale University, where his papers are. And he made in those diaries statement after statement about Jews that he saw as being an insidious force, hard to ferret out, but behind the push for the nation to go to war. And that he blamed for sabotaging his events and claimed that they had outsized ownership and influence in the media, which all studies show that, in fact, other than ownership of the New York Times at that time and the Hollywood movie studios, you know, really had no significant ownership role in the media. And then you had people in this liberal center. Theodore Roosevelt Jr. figures importantly in my book. Ted Roosevelt, you know, he was actually involved in ecumenical groups. He was very active in all kinds of civil rights movements and very much opposed to what he saw as anti-Semitism within the anti-war movement. But he was very much an isolationist. He was the son of President Teddy Roosevelt. He was himself a hero in World War I. His knee had been badly shot up. He got involved with America First, the organization that Charles Lindbergh became the chief spokesperson for, as did some of his siblings. You know, and part of that was they just simply hated FDR. They hated Franklin Roosevelt.
You show a real hatred between the two branches of the Roosevelts, the the Oyster Bay Roosevelts and the and FDR's Roosevelts, the Hyde Park. And boy, it was like personal. It was just a nasty breakdown. We should mention that that I think American Jews were no more pro-war than anyone else. In fact, they were just as much a part of the peace movement as others. And that the people that were driving toward the war, and this is the one area where, while Lindbergh was certainly an anti-Semite and he had it wrong with Jewish conspiracies, it did seem to be something that was the purview of an elite group, kind of the top group of people. And I don't even necessarily think FDR was part of that. But they were pushing for war on the inside. FDR's policy, on the other hand, was one that would eventually be described in 1948 against the Soviet Union as containment, maybe with a little extra mustard on it. You know, he wanted to contain the Nazi expansion and aggression without necessarily entering into a shooting war. I mean, he was very good at defining the nature of the enemy as evil and contrasting it with our society, which he identified as superior. He did a very good job with that, in the same way that Reagan did with the Soviet Union. And I wonder, looking back at this, because I've always taken the conventional view that we should absolutely have gotten it right away, perhaps that policy would have been the more effective policy in terms, it may not have been as quick, but it would have saved a lot of American lives if we had just contained the Nazis and allowed them eventually to implode on their own rot, like we did with the Soviets 30 years later.
Well, first let's step back for a minute and actually look at what FDR was doing, because I think you sort of overstate his unwillingness to actually go to war. I think FDR acted in what he perceived to be the national interest, and also that he was a politician with his antenna up. And he understood that the American people weren't ready for war. I think that he made that he could have, as Henry Stimson, his Secretary of War, said, you know, he could have had taken much more forceful executive leadership to bring the Americans into the war. But he actually, throughout 1941, he was in the process of moving American forces more and more towards a footing that can only be said to be towards confronting Hitler's forces. I mean, he was moving the most powerful portion of the U.S. military, which was the Navy, step by step to the east in the Atlantic Ocean, until finally in July 1941, we occupied Iceland. And
right.
We set up patrols right in the midst of the declared German combat zone. We had destroyers sailing out there. They were not. We were still neutral, and they were still what was officially called the neutrality patrol, but they were looking for warships. And they were announcing their presence, and American aircraft were patrolling within a few hundred miles of the UK. So inevitably, he understood that inevitably there were going to be confrontations between U.S. warships and German U-boats. And in certain respects, he was using the United States Navy as bait to create a series of military, violent military encounters that would, he hoped, lead the American people to push him into war. You know,
right.
He was unwilling to go to war. And,
well, he was looking for an incident
to create a war, a willingness to go to war, and you know, to do so, he was basically saying that our defense lines extend all the way almost to the shores of Great Britain. And he was also sending American forces to fly with the RAF to be trained in combat piloting. And as it turned out, they actually ended up being relief pilots for the RAF. It was an American pilot who spotted the Bismarck and almost got blown right out of the sky for it. So really, we can't say that Roosevelt wasn't attempting to lead the country to war. But as he said at one point, it's terrible to think you're leading and then look back over your shoulder and find that that nobody's following you. And so he understood that the American people needed something, essentially a huge spark, if they were going to go to that explosive level of total war that it would take to defeat Nazi Germany. Now, it was a shock.
Yeah, I think what you're saying is absolutely true. I mean, he wanted to – he needed to get support, popular support, to go to war. He was spoiling for war, probably as far back as the very beginning. Even if you take a look at the history during World War One, when he was Undersecretary of the Navy under Wilson, he was spoiling for war then. I mean, he actually – when the Secretary of the Navy was on vacation, he took several maneuvers that – would put America in harm's way of the Navy so that there could be an incident. I mean, this was he was part of a movement that wanted to involve the United States in a world war. The question I have, and what I'm looking at, and we can all look in retrospect, was this really something that would have been necessary ultimately to defeat the Nazis? And I think that you have in your book, you say that Hitler was trying to avoid any confrontation with the United States. He was involved in a death struggle with the Soviet Union, and I think that it was none other than Senator Harry Truman, I think, who expressed the American sentiment at the time when he said that let these two evil empires, these two behemoths, these two socialistic entities, you know, these two progressive experiments or whatever, let them duke it out and they'll basically exhaust each other. I mean, in a sense, a policy of containment. I mean, I think Roosevelt was right to support the British and to basically take over in Iceland because that's our perimeter of defense. But to actually have instigated the hot war and also with Japan too, I mean, to cut off their trade supplies to the degree that they were backed into a corner and ended up occupying Southeast Asia, it was a policy that was instigating war, and I'm not sure in retrospect it was necessary to defeat these socialistic monsters.
Well, I think that that's a retrospect question, what if question. One of the things that we have to be very aware of was that in Washington, in London, and certainly in Berlin, the perception was that the Soviet Union wouldn't last 2 months after the Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union. Now, Hitler's view of this was that once he had gotten rid of Stalin and captured the breadbasket of Ukraine, which was, of course, a big part of his Lebensraum, his intentions, this need to find territory for the Aryan people to expand into and to provide food for them. You know, while you talk about, well, you know, let these two horrible empires fight it out. In the meanwhile, the German intention there, with the Nazi intention, was to murder all of the Jews there, which they essentially did, and then and to enslave the Slavic peoples and work and starve them to death. You know, so this is there is no we can't. In retrospect, in any kind of humanitarian perspective, simply take this sort of political view that says, well, God, let them beat each other to death because, you know, the victims of this were millions and millions of people.
The
vast majority of them
view,
innocents.
Of course. I think the American view, as expressed by Truman, was that both sides were equally evil when it came to those sorts of records. Let's not forget that Lenin had already slaughtered 3 to 4 million people before Hitler even joined the Nazi Party. I mean, this was, you know, they had set up a system of concentration camps they called the Gulag, which was imitated by the Nazis. Their Cheka was imitated by the Nazis when they developed the Gestapo. I mean, their whole system of government was emulated and admired by the Nazis as they set up their model.
Well,
so
I think Hitler had a very evil... Yeah.
You know, both
sides were equally evil. Yeah, well, I don't know whether
I mean, I
whether we should get...
I mean, I personally believe the Nazis were worse because I'm a Jew, and of course, you know, that's an unprecedented event in history, of course, but of course that hadn't happened yet in 1941. Mm-hmm. It was the Wannsee Conference wasn't until 1942. But the point is that these two evil empires were, you know, they were equally, I think, should have been viewed as enemies of the Western democracies, and perhaps using the Keenan model, which came on later, they could have been isolated and encircled in the same way maybe that we might look today at Islamic terror. You know, these are systems that, I mean, when I read some of Roosevelt's statements as he describes the Nazis, it reminds me of today, the enemy that we face. I mean, you know, these are enemies of America, enemies of the Judeo-Christian civilization.
Yeah. Well,
you
know, I think we have to be...
Both of them were.
Well, let's be very, very, very careful about making comparisons between a nation-state with a with the powers of a great nation state and a 10 million man military force and a large industrial base and a long national history that was in the process of expanding and using industrial murder and terror at home to create its and reinforce its power. Let's be extremely cautious about comparing that to the elements of scattered elements that are largely disorganized, highly, in many cases, most cases, impoverished members of a religious faith who have no significant state organization behind them. You know, to compare the one to the other is,
well,
you know, to compare a hammer to a fingernail.
My comparison is more ideological than it is physical, but I do compare the Nazis and the communists because we should point out that after the war, the Soviet Union and their allies spearheaded the occupation of about a third of the planet. And so, you know, we had, you know, they were, you know, you mentioned in the book in a very admirable way the role of Harry Hopkins as an advisor to the president and how he created a liaison with the British, and he played a sort of an insider role in getting the parties on the same page with regard to eventually going to war. But his record wasn't so great when it came to dealing with the Soviet Union. And there's information that's been revealed, particularly George Racy Jordan's diary, who worked under Hopkins, that indicate that Hopkins was helping the Soviets get nuclear material in the 1940s. I mean,
Hopkins was investigated quite thoroughly. Hopkins' telephones were tapped. There has never been a shred of evidence that has been brought forward that proves in any way that he was a Soviet agent. What he was, and this was quite clear, was somebody who believed that ultimately Hitler had to be defeated, and he went to the Soviet Union at a time in early August of 1941 when the vast majority of people around the world believed the Soviet Union was going to collapse. And while you talk about containing, you know, the Soviets, containing the Nazi Germany, the reality was if the Soviet Union fell, that would have given Hitler essentially the keys to the kingdom, and that would have made it impossible for Great Britain to stand up to Hitler and the Nazis. And ultimately then we would have been faced with the potential for Hitler to have control of all of Europe, continental Europe, into the Soviet Union, including its industrial and resources, natural resources, controlling from the southern shores of the Mediterranean all the way to the Arctic Circle. And at that point, the U.S. would have been truly isolated, and Hitler would have potentially have taken the Royal Navy and the Royal Air Force, and the U.S. would have been left to fight on alone. And then you would have had the situation in which the Axis would have been invoked, and you, which it was in any case when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, and you would have had the U.S. not just facing a two-front, two-ocean war, but facing it absolutely alone with no allies at all. You know, in that situation, you know, if you say, well, this would have been potentially a better outcome, well, then I think you're whistling in the dark and thinking that a flashlight is the sun.
Mark, you make very good points. No, you make a solid case that a scenario of what might have happened. I think that it's easy to say in hindsight for any of us, but to my way of thinking, both the Nazi and the communist movements were so evil and so anti-human in a way, and antithetical to basic freedoms that individuals enjoy in this country, that it would have imploded as it did in the Soviet Union without firing a shot. It would have extended itself. I mean, Russia was not going to give up, and we knew that already by the summer of 1941. And, they weren't going to be able to ultimately prevail there. I mean, that became pretty clear.
Well, that's the perception that we've gained as the result of, you know, the deaths of 20 million Soviet Red Army soldiers and the murder of nearly 6 million Jews, as well as countless other so-called inferior people in the territories that the Nazi forces overran, you know that,
right.
To think that that at the time that the Red Army was going to hold out was, that was by no means the common viewpoint from Henry Stimson.
You mentioned in your book that generally that was the impression of several Americans who were on the inside, including Hopkins himself, who was convinced that
Hopkins,
the Soviets would be able to.
You know, this is why Hopkins was so important in this era, is because Hopkins, when he went to Moscow and met with Stalin, who presented him, you know, here Stalin and the United States had essentially been already in a Cold War for decades.
Right.
You know, and no high American official had ever met with Stalin. You know, here you had Harry Hopkins, the president's alter ego, coming to Moscow, and Stalin telling him, essentially giving him the keys to the kingdom as far as explaining what the Soviet military capabilities were, where its industrial bases were, what it needed in order to hold out. And this was at a point at which the Nazi army was already within 200 miles of Moscow. You know, when Hopkins was there, Moscow was under bombardment. So Hopkins did not go there with the belief that the Soviets would simply hold out and then reverse the tide. He was going there to understand whether they could possibly stand up against this fierce, fierce, experienced, well-equipped German army. And most high U.S. officials did not think they would, and in fact said, there is absolutely no reason to aid the Soviet Union, because if we aid them, that equipment's just going to fall into the hands of the Nazis. So Hopkins did was he basically got a very, very clear, factually based and empirical viewpoint of the state of the Red Army And he was able to convince President Roosevelt, against the advice of his military leaders, that in fact, with American aid, the Soviet Union would be able to hold out, and that whether that would be sufficient to turn the tide and actually defeat Hitler was by no means clear at that point. But what was clear was that the most important thing for the U.S. national interest, you know, this is not a question of defeating Hitler or not. It was a question of the U.S. national interest, that the most important thing for the defense of the United States was that Hitler be preoccupied militarily as long as possible in the Soviet Union. So,
Sure. But of course, I think as the war dragged on and as the United States got involved, it was quite clear that the Soviets had turned the tide and had gotten the upper hand. And I think we kind of stayed a little too cozy with them after that, because they ended up betraying our values, double-crossing Europe and marching on to a brutal occupation of Eastern Europe, not to mention a bunch of other things. So, but
yeah,
anyway,
we
could debate that. That's a whole different ball of wax. Mark Wertman, I want to thank you for joining me. It's a very interesting book. I appreciate you writing it. I've really enjoyed it. How can people get it?
Well, they can get it at their local bookseller. They can get it from Amazon, or they can go to my website, which is markwortmanbooks.com. It's MarkWortmanBooks, books, markwortmanbooks.com, and find out more information about me. I've written two previous books, one about aviators in World War I, another about the rise and fall of Atlanta in the Civil War. And find ways to get a hold of 1941 Fighting the Shadow War. It's available wherever good books are sold.
And you know, you're a good war writer, by the way. I mean, you capture the atmosphere very well. Anyway, thanks so much, Mark. I appreciate it.
Okay, Chuck. I really appreciate you inviting me on and your listeners for listening in.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
You too.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, so that's Mark Wertman. He's the author of 1941. My books, of course, are available at Amazon Kindle. Put in my name, Chuck Morse, M-O-R-S-E, like Morse code, and they'll come up. And again, I want to thank Mark Wertman for joining me. The book is 1941, Shadow War, A Divided America in a World at War. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a good day.